tonight on Arena. Actor Patrick Bergen on being celebrated at this year's Galway Film Flam. And Esther Freud continues her family story in her new novel, My Sister and Other Lovers. +51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena. The 37th Galway Film Flam starts today. It runs through until July the 13th. A rich programme, including 80 feature films, with approximately a quarter of them being world premieres. The festival aims to highlight both emerging and established filmmakers and provide a platform for new voices in cinema. This year, acclaimed Irish actor Patrick Bergen will feature in two very different film selections at the Fla, a rare honour for any performer. But with more than 80 screen credits and a career spanning over three decades, Bergen's dual showcase is a testament not just to his talent but to his deep commitment to powerful storytelling. The two films at the Fla are Sunflower, an Irish film written and directed by Dave Byrne, that will have its world premiere at the festival on July the 10th, and The Captain, in which Patrick Bergen plays a retired sea captain under house arrest for robbing a local shop, and that will be screened tomorrow, July the 9th at 3:30 p.m. Absolutely delighted to have Patrick Bergen join us from Galway this evening. What an honour that is for you, Patrick. Unusual to have two films showing at a festival in the way that you have here.
So I believe, I think I'm the only actor that has them this year anyway.
Yeah.
And thank you, Sean, for having me, listening to me.
No, not at all. I'm delighted that you can join us and talk about what is an astonishing career, really, over a period of time. But let's stick for the time being with the films that you're doing at the Fla. Let's talk about those, in particular The Captain. He's quite a rum old character, is Fergus Rooney, isn't he?
Fergus Rooney is a very strange, very wonderful character. He's based on a real life character that Jamie Pattison, the director, spotted around Brighton in the south coast of England. And he scoots around on his mobile, and he's lost both his legs. And he has a sort of an intriguing life, and he has a yearning and a yearning to go back to sea. So he has his eye on a yacht that he needs to get back. And he hasn't got the money, so he decides to rob his local shop.
It's a wonderful opening scene, I have to say, that where we see you as Fergus with a little bandana up over your face to try to disguise you. But of course, the shopkeeper knows you coming into the shop for years, so there's no disguise. There's a great sense of fun in it, but all along with the Fergus character, and I guess this must have been one of the attractions for you, Patrick, you get a sense, yeah, he's gruff exterior and he's a bit rough and ready, but there is a very soft centre when you get in there.
There's a charming centre to him, all right. And it takes this young Greek girl, Eleni, to come. He gets put under house arrest. Mm-hmm. And he's given a young girl, Eleni, she's a Greek girl, and she sort of is to look after him and do his housekeeping and things for him while he's under house arrest. And it's a sort of a, like a light comedy between the two of them for the duration of the film.
Yeah,
a very, 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 very charming story and a very charming characters.
Yeah, you wonder how she has patience with him. I want to play a clip which is from very early on in the film, actually, their very first meeting. She's been sent along by an agency to deal with the captain, and he wants to be called the captain. He doesn't want to be called anything else.
He likes the title.
He certainly does. Let's listen to Eleni Lordanopoulou then as the character of Lenny, and yourself, Patrick Bergen, as the character of Fergus in the film The Captain.
Mr. Rooney.
Who the fuck are you and what are you doing in my house?
I'm only here to help.
Do I look like I need help?
I don't know. I just got the job. That's all I know.
You broke into my house.
What? No. Look, the agency gave me the keys. I let myself in.
What agency? CIA, MI5, MI6?
What? Yellowbird Care? Look, I'm honestly here to help.
Why should I believe you?
Okay, when I was a kid, I once ate a penny sweet without paying for it, and I couldn't sleep for 6 months. I felt so bad, I stopped eating. Eventually, I did go and pay for it, but the shop owner just laughed in my face. And that was the last time I ever stole anything.
What's your name?
Lenny.
Lenny? What kind of name is that?
Greek. Were you gonna kill yourself?
What does it matter to you?
I thought the police took your gun.
I have many guns.
I think I should go.
No. Stay. You're here now. Do you know how to make a builder's cup of tea?
Is that the same as a normal cup of tea?
No. You use 2 tea bags and 3 big spoonfuls of sugar.
3 sugars. Yes, I can. I can, Fergus.
Captain!
Sir?
You're in my house now. I'm the captain of this house. You call me captain.
Yes. Yes, captain.
What are you waiting for? The tea won't make itself.
Patrick Bergen there as the captain. I dare not call him Fergus Rooney. And Elena Lordanopoulou as the character of Lenny in a scene.
I can't wait to see it tomorrow.
Oh, have you not seen it yet, Patrick?
I have seen it, yeah, but I'm looking forward to seeing it on the big screen.
Yeah, I can imagine seeing it up on that is a different experience altogether. Are you partial to the builder's cup of tea, by the way, with the 2 tea bags and the 3 spoons of sugar?
The builder's tea without sugar.
You'll have the 2 tea bags, but no sugar. Thank you very much.
There you go, yeah. A nice strong cup of tea, already.
It really does give a sense, that scene, of the range that this character has from, you know, he's quite, and I should have mentioned the broad F towards the top of the clip, but he softens so much and then he hardens up again. He's very careful about letting himself be seen, really, isn't he?
He is. It's a lovely arc of a character, and it shows how, through tenderness and honesty, a character can soften. And but yet, at the same time, you get a sense that he's had a past and a rough life. Life at sea has to be rough in all shapes and forms. Being away from home, being out at sea, and he's clearly had a life worth living. And He wants to go back to sea. He wants that life back somehow, in some sort of primitive way.
Yeah, I'm interested just hearing you talk about the character in that way, and I'm wondering when you're approaching a character like this. Obviously, the script, and you mentioned Jamie Patterson, who is both the writer and director here, and a lecturer in the Met Film School in Brighton. You mentioned, you know, him approaching you with the script, but to what extent would you, as an actor, would you get involved in writing down biographies for the background of the character for yourself, or do you just, you know, do that imaginatively? Some people write them out, some people just have them in the back of their head.
Essentially did it imaginatively, but we did chat about the character, and obviously the little bits of the real me is in there, but it's mainly Jamie.
Yeah.
And his vision of what this man, he used to see this man like he'd be traveling by on a bus or something, he'd see him on the street or whatever. And it was Jamie's imagination, really, that put it together.
Put the story on top of him. How different is the character Tony, then? That I mentioned the other film that's been shown at the FLA, Sunflower, by an Irish film written and directed by Dave Byrne. How different is the role that you have there, Patrick?
He's a lot more supportive and sensitive in his own way. He's almost doing the role that Lenny does in The Captain.
Mm.
Because this wonderful character played by Anne McCrudden in Sunflowers.
Mm.
She suffered some heartbreak, and is trying to reshape her life. And she decides to grow sunflowers. And my character Tony helps her out in a very tender and practical way as well. And he rallies the village behind her. It's a very heartwarming story. In that sense, he's the opposite to the captain.
Yeah, as you
he's
say,
playing the role of the Eleni. Yeah.
Yeah, more like the young Greek woman in the captain, you're the other side of that dynamic. Great that you know, here you are at this stage in your career, getting characters with that much meat on the bones and with that much variety across them.
I'm very fortunate. I'm no complaints. I've been very lucky with my career. As you say, I've done over 80 movies, and it's taken me to the north, south, east, and west of the world, and a whole range of characters, from Robin Hood to to all sorts of characters, to Dracula, to Frankenstein, and I've seen it quite a bit. But it's nice to have characters that are sort of fresh and real and new, and these characters have a reality to them. And these films, they're charming films. They're not fantasy films. And I think it might appeal to people when they look at it, because there's a reality to them that's very important.
Yeah, certainly within The Captain, there's no doubt that there's a very real story in behind the fun and the games and some of the nasty manipulation that he gets up to as well.
But exactly, yeah.
But I do have to go back to one of the great manipulators of all time, of course, Martin from Sleeping with the Enemy. Shall we have a listen? Yeah. Can we have a little listen to a clip from Sleeping with the Enemy from 1991? A huge film, obviously, in your career, Patrick. You were opposite Julia Roberts. She was playing your wife. And to say that Martin is a nasty bit of business is really understating it. Let's warn people about the violence. And it's very immediate. And you don't need to see it to get a sense of what's going on here. This is from Sleeping with the Enemy.
Nice looking man, the doctor.
Doctor?
He says I have a beautiful house. Best on the beach. When was he in here? Yesterday while I was in town?
Martin, I don't know the doctor.
Sure you do. Young, good looking, outfitting his sailboat down there. He says you've been staring at him from the window all day.
Have Patrick Bergen and Julia Roberts in a scene from the 1991 film Sleeping with the Enemy. Patrick Bergen speaking to me this evening from Galway ahead of the screening of two of his films, which will be shown at the Film Fla tomorrow and the day after. It's absolutely chilling, Patrick, when you listen
it's
to
so
that.
Scary. It's really scary. It's amazing and it still works so well. It truly is a classic in that sense.
Because it struck me, you know, listening and watching to parts of it over the last couple of days, and that scene is just, you're so charming in the beginning, but boy, does it turn on the sixpence. I mean, in 1991, I'm not sure how much, coercive behaviour and coercive control and domestic violence, how much they were acceptable as topics for a film. It must have been, what was the kind of reception to that, do you remember, around the time?
I don't remember in terms of, except that it was a very, very, it took over 100 million in January at the box office. Mm. It was the biggest selling film of the year. And so it was very popular in that sense of the word. And but I think there was some, it also encouraged people to discuss domestic violence. And I think it did have an influence on certain groups of people, all right. To look upon what was usually considered a subject that you wouldn't really deal with in the movies. And I think it has done a lot of good work in its own way.
Yeah, it certainly opened up, as you say, opened up that debate and those conversations which are so necessary to be had. Was Hollywood then, I mean, you went over there as a relatively young whippersnapper with relatively few other film credits under your belt. Was Hollywood in the late 80s and early 90s, was it a very different place from the Hollywood that you've spent time in the intervening period?
Well, it was all, I was younger and it was very exciting for me. And to be offered this role was extraordinary. I just had come back from Africa where I'd done a film called Mountains of the Moon, which was my big breakthrough. And with the director, Bob Ravelson, who has since passed, God rest him. And he was one of the most respected directors in Hollywood. So the mere fact that he had chosen me to work with him brought me a lot of kudos and got to meet people, his other actors that worked with him, Jack Nicholson, and et cetera. And so I was in a very good, and it was the head of 20th Century Fox had come to see the screening of Mountains of the Moon in New York, and it was at that meeting that at that screening that he approached me tentatively to see if I'd be interested in coming to see them in LA. And a very funny thing happened was that I went to LA very, very nervous, dressed myself up in a 9-piece suit, you know, and went into the meeting with all the executives at 20th Century Fox. And they were all around the table and they were asking me questions, and I answered them as succinctly as possible, et cetera, et cetera. And they said, thank you very much, Patrick, and we'll be in touch. And I stood up to leave and walked straight into the broom closet. And it was Joe Rubin, the director, said, it was the look on my face coming out of the broom closet that got me the part.
No acting involved at all.
No. That was my audition.
Yeah, well, there you go. It's amazing the things that might just get you apart if you think about it. I'm also thinking about, I mean, Hollywood then, film had such a, you know, a very particular status, and if you were a film star, you wouldn't dare be a television star. And yet then I think of you, you know, particularly more recently in EastEnders on BBC and in Red Rock, I think it was on the BBC at the stage you were in, I think series 4 you were in, but it had started here on TV3. The status of television now, has that changed? Have you noticed how that has changed across your career?
Oh, very much so. And of course now it's moved on to Netflix, etc. Mm. And they are huge canvases that they're able to paint now. But I always had an interest, like Bob Dylan, I liked Coronation Street.
So you're quite happy to go on to EastEnders as a result. I do have to mention a local soap, obviously, Glenroe and your beloved brother Emmett, your older brother.
God rest him.
Our sympathies. I'm wondering, you know, Emmett had such a fine stage career here in Ireland and very well known as Dick Bourne, obviously, in Glenroe. How much did you two young lads from Drimna bounce off each other in terms of career decisions and what you were doing?
Well, he was a bit older than me, and so we did. We were never in the same in any competition in that sense. And I just had very fond memories of seeing him, and he was a great inspiration to me. I mean, so one of the first plays I ever went to see in town was at Philadelphia, Here I Come. He was in the original cast of the Brian Friel play. And my mother was working in the green room in the Gaiety at the time. And also my dad, that my father started the Little Theatre in Carlow in the late 40s, early 50s, late 50s it would have been. And it's still running. And so there was theatre and the arts in that sense, very much in the family.
Yeah, well, clearly it wasn't off the ground that either yourself or Emmett picked it up then. It was coming at you from all sides. Patrick, lovely to have spoken with you this evening. Thanks so much for being with us on Arena.
Thank you.
And enjoy Galway.
And enjoy sunflowers and enjoy the captain when you can see them.
We'll do for sure. That's Patrick Bergen speaking to us there from Galway. And both films starring Patrick will be screened at the Galway Film Fla this week. The Captain will be at the Palace tomorrow, July the 9th at 3:30 p.m. Sunflowers will have its world premiere on Thursday the 10th of July, 9:30 p.m. in the Town Hall Theatre. Full details on galwayfilmfla.com. In 1992, Esther Freud burst onto the literary scene with Hideous Kinky, a fictionalized account of her childhood adventures in Spain and Morocco with her mother and older sister Bella. It was turned into a film and subsequent novels. In subsequent novels, Esther has explored her time in a stepfamily, the life of her German Jewish godmother, and the influence of Catholicism on her London Irish mother. In her latest book, My Sister and Other Lovers, Esther Freud returns to the life of Hideous Kinky's narrator, Lucy, and follows the teenage years and young adult of Lucy and her sister Bea as they attempt to come to terms with the fallout from a deeply unconventional childhood. Delighted that Esther Freud joins us on Arena this evening. Has Lucy been at you since 1992, saying, would you ever come back and give me another chance to speak to the people, Esther, please?
I wish she had been. I mean, she may have been deep in my subconscious, but I didn't think I was writing a sequel. so many writers say this, if they knew what they were doing when they started writing a book, the book could have been written in a few months. But I had the idea for this book a couple of years into writing it, when I just thought, what is this strange book? Nothing's really pulling together. There's all these stories and people are doing this and that. And I kind of had to pull it apart and remake it. And I started to see that I was really exploring this familiar triangular relationship that I had explored all those years ago when I wrote my first novel.
When you wrote that first novel, Hideous Kinky, back in, I suppose it would have been the late 80s, early 90s when you were writing, it was published then in 1992. Am I right in thinking it was a somewhat similar experience? You were kind of just jotting down, you were working as an actor at the time, and then you started doing a bit of writing, I think, on the side. I hope that's not an insulting way of putting it.
No, not at all. I had a much clearer idea, and as a result, the book was written quite quickly. I was acting, and as anyone who knows much about the lives of actors, I had quite a lot of time on my hands. And I had been writing sort of sketches and songs, and I had things that most of the writing I was writing was sort of comedy based and performance based. But I found myself kind of thrown back, just alone, sitting in my kitchen table, and I thought, maybe I'll try and write down the story of this unusual couple of years that we had as children, when my mother in the mid-60s, late-60s, decided to take me and my sister, we were 4 and 6, to North Africa, where we spent a year and a half traveling and living. And so I had a plan. And in a way, I had the opposite problem, is that once I started, I realized, even though this story had filled my head for my whole childhood, I realized when it came to it, I had like 3 or 4 pages worth of anecdotes, and I had to stare at the blank page and try and kind of see my way into it, almost like I was watching a film. So that's the way that story came alive.
And interesting then that I wonder to what extent then did the fictionalizing of the story, because yes, there are huge parallels with your own life, with your mother and your sister. But I'm sure you're going to tell me, yeah, sure, they're all me. All of the characters in the novel are me. It's not one particular that's me. But was the blank page part of the decision to fictionalize rather than it be a memoir?
It never even occurred to me for it to be a memoir, partly because I couldn't remember enough for it to be a convincing memoir. So I had to kind of bring it alive. So I didn't think so deeply about how I was going to tell this story. I just wanted to tell it. And even when it was happening, it felt like a bit of a story. It was like such unusual things would happen. I would find myself telling it to myself, even at the time, as a story. And then when I was a little bit of an older child back at school in England, I would often tell people the stories of our adventures in Morocco, to the point where my nickname became In Morocco, which I could tell wasn't an entirely complimentary nickname. And I started to back off with that. So I had always thought of it as a story. And even I would say it's very, I wanted to keep the spirit of our adventure and the characters that I created very much based on me and my sister, that I was the follower, the watcher, the one who kind of trotted along afterwards. Yeah. And my sister was sort of powerful character who kind of engaged with life in a much more upfront way.
So that was 1992. I suppose the benefit of hindsight, maybe that's why you kind of were slow to embrace it in 20, whenever you were writing, I suppose, 20, 22, 3, 4, at that point. Were you a little slower to embrace this family story again, even though it's a fictionalized version, and even though there are going to be things that did or didn't happen that are expanded upon and imagined a little bit? Were you wary about coming back to it?
Yes, I was a bit wary. I think it's because people very much assumed everything in that book was true, because, I was completely open. This is based on our lives. You couldn't make something like that up. But to make a book, to make a novel, you have to play with the truth as well, or exaggerate in the direction of the truth, as one great writer said at some point. So I was wary, and in fact, I changed the names for most of the writing time, because I wanted to free myself from the expectation that I was following these characters. I wanted them to be able to go wherever they wanted, or to create lives for them that really felt right and alive for them, rather than people assuming that this was me and my sister.
Yeah,
but once I'd finished it, it was actually my sister Bella who read it in an early draft and said, "What are all these ridiculous names? Yeah, just own it, go for it, just be brave." And I went, "Really, really?" And then actually, that's when the book really took off.
But you stuck with the names Lucy and BA. You didn't. And interestingly, particularly, I'm not sure if it's the case in Hideous Kinky. I'm sorry that I don't have that detail at the tip of my finger right now. But certainly in My Sister and Other Lovers, it's mother and father that we hear about. We don't get names for mother and father. And your father famously, of course, was Lucian Freud, or is Lucian Freud the painter.
Yes. I mean, in the first book, in Hideous Kinky, it's really very much told from a five-year-old's point of view. So it's just mom, mom, mom,
yeah. In
the way that the kids repeat this. And in the second book, she is their mother. We meet them first as teenagers. In fact, in Ireland.
Absolutely.
Hitchhiking around West Cork, looking for a place to stay. And That was born out of a short story that came very easily when I had finished my last book. I was still very much kind of in the world of Ireland in my head. And so I wrote that story and it kind of made me go, oh, maybe I'll write some short stories. So this book actually began out of a series of about 12 short stories. And I started to look at it and go, what could this be about? It's not quite enough, this book of short stories. And I, every so often, a sister would pop up, you know, the sister. And that's when I kind of thought, if I turn this book into a book about the relationship of two sisters over about sort of 15, 20 years from teenage to mid-30s, it's actually very, very interesting to explore.
And also when I saw the title first, My Sister and Other Lovers, I thought, that sounds like the title of a collection of stories. Peculiarly enough, it has that feel off it. You know, My Sister and Other Stories, it's only an inch off that.
Yeah. Well, that's how it began. It was actually because the first story, they find themselves in a house in Bantry listening to the only record that they can find, which is Bob Dylan's Desire. There was just a bit of Bob Dylan playing as I was waiting to come on. And so the book was initially called Desire and Other Stories. And I was like, it's not really about desire, really. It's quite provocative, but it's really about love. And it's really about sisters. So I kind of kept the word other. And changed it around.
And sorry to be so parochial, but to go back to the initial part of the book where Lucy and B and their mother are in Ireland, particularly down in Wexford and over in Cork and over towards Bantry, indeed where the Bob Dylan that you heard is, ironically enough, it's part of a festival in that part of the world. Was that, you say it was based on a short story, but was there some essence of fact in that? Because your mother was originally Irish.
Yes. Her mother was from Cork, and she was brought up in London, but the family moved back when she was a teenager. And so we'd spend a lot of time in Ireland every summer, really. And so, yes, it's very much based on experience. And what there was a marvellous thing that actually happened while we were in West Cork once. It sounds so unlikely, but this was the sort of genesis of the story. A man dressed in sort of Tibetan robes rushed up and gave us an album. George Harrison's solo album, he said, and he wanted us to have it for a small donation. And I always remembered the hilarity of that moment. And I thought, that's got to go into a story.
Yeah.
And he started the conversation by saying, "Have you heard of the Beatles?" And we were so affronted and offended, like, well, obviously, you know.
The other aspect, though, of the Irish part of the story is your mother's... the mother's, I beg your pardon, but the mother's early teen pregnancy, which is a reflection of your own mother's situation, and the fear of bringing these two girls back home to Ireland because she could end up in a mother and baby home.
Well, I guess I still had very much in my mind, my books kind of breed books, and the book that I had published before I started writing this one, I Couldn't Love You More, was all about a sort of alternative existence of a woman a little bit like my mother who becomes pregnant in a kind of bohemian London, late 50s, early 60s world, and is fearful that she might, like so many, end up in a mother and baby home. That wasn't my mother's story at all. But I was very much living in that headspace still. And so I gave that story to the mother in this book because it added so much extra history and depth to her experience of bringing, and also the shame of having had another failed relationship, which is what's brought the family back to Ireland at that point.
And that a number of failed relationships passed the mother's way within the telling of the story here. And that seems to have passed its way on to Bea and Lucy, these fictional characters. What aspects do you think of reality are at play there in terms of your mother's own situation and how you and your sister have carried on your relationships?
Yeah, well, I guess the thing about being a writer is you have the luxury of exploring all the kind of difficult times and the inherited damages and the inherited privileges of an unconventional life. And so, yeah, I really wanted to look at how either a person rebels against their upbringing and has a very settled and stable life if their parents have been more rebellious, or they can't quite move on from the example that's been set to them. So I was kind of playing with those ideas. I mean, there's a lot to explore in this book, and it's not a very long book, but it's packed with their stories. And I kind of kept the what I had found in my short stories was I had big gaps of time where you meet the characters again and they're with it in a new relationship, or they've got different friends, just like meeting up with an old friend. You don't always find out everything that's gone on in between. Yeah. And I had quite a lot of fun with that, where you think, oh, what now? Certainly more interesting than writing about a long marriage, which is something that I have experienced, a long marriage. But yeah, harder to write about, you know, on their 20th anniversary. I don't know, maybe I'll try that one day.
On their 20th anniversary, they had another lovely dinner celebrating 20 fine years. You know, it doesn't really, doesn't have the same thing as I think you mentioned somewhere along the way, the ice in the heart that Graham Greene kind of talks about. That's what the writer needs. Also interesting that your own father, Lucian Freud, talked about his work being almost like memoir. That must have struck you when you were writing these books.
That's such a good point. He did say that, although I hadn't quite taken that in. I suppose what I felt when I started to write my novels was that whereas a lot of people don't really feel free to write about their families for fear of upsetting them, and it's not that I don't have that fear, I do, but my parents were both... my parents were very courageous people, and they had lived the life exactly as they wished to live. So I knew that they weren't going to come down hard on me and say, what are you doing? writing about personal things. They had, my father particularly had made, he had created sort of memoirs with his art and followed the story of his life just by the sitters that he chose, the styles that he moved from one to the next, the way that he had sort of investigated what was possible with painting.
And then, of course, we had the film version of Hideous Kinky. And you open this book with a conversation about Hideous Kinky and how the mother in the book feels about that particular film and why are we washing our dirty linen in public. That sounds as if it's a reflection of reality, but I'm not sure if you just said the direct opposite to me.
Well, I guess it's kind of, I was playing a little bit because I give the older sister the job of writing the film, and she's the one who has a much more conflicted relationship with the past. And so she's got some axes to grind, and it makes it kind of, in a way, I was trying to pull the tension tighter. So when she writes a film script that gets made, and she says, you know, I'm using some of our childhood. There's a sort of ripple of terror that runs through Lucy, who's very protective of her mother. Whereas when my actual film was made, my mother was very supportive and on side. I'm not saying it was easy for her.
Yeah.
Literally no one wants their 5-year-old child to remember what happened and write it down. That's just not what anyone wants. But But with Bee's story, you know, she spends the whole book railing against what she feels has been a difficult childhood and an unhappy childhood. And so when she writes a film, it's a lot more painful, and it throws everybody into sort of some kind of crisis.
Yeah, and I did kind of, hoping not to confuse people, I did get confused myself initially with Bee is the character in the novel who writes the film. Esther is the younger sister in reality who wrote the film. Lucy is the character in the novel, the younger sister who becomes a designer. Bella is the older sister in real life who is a designer. You were playing with us when you did that, Esther.
I was, but you're making it sound so much worse than it is.
But how does
it really does? It's very convincing.
I know it makes total sense. You know, it's only when you try to compare it to real life that you get scuppered, and maybe that's the point.
Yeah,
but Bella is I think your actual sister writing about the family now as well. Am I right in thinking that? And how has she responded to your portrayal of her as a filmmaker in this book?
Oh dear. Yes, I mean, in a way, that's one of the things that sort of freed me up and gave me the idea that Bella, who's always been very private and a visual person and hasn't written, although she's a very good reader and editor of my own work, she started to write these little Sunday stories that she publishes on Instagram. Absolutely marvelous. And whereas I have always fictionalized the stories I've told, however closely or not they're based in life, she's just, you know, this is a slice of memoir. And I often have the thought, that's not what it was like. And then I think, how many times must she have thought that?
Yeah.
And she's never said anything. And she's been so accepting. I mean, my father inspired us both by his creativity. And also, she told me this quite recently, that after my second novel, Peerless Flats, which I do draw quite heavily on sort of family dynamics and his character. And he said to me, gosh, for a minute, I thought it was me in that book. And then I thought, oh, no, I don't wear a watch. And he also said to Bella, it's a novel. It's a novel. So don't worry about it. And I thought that was so generous of him. And she said, so don't worry, write whatever you want. It's a novel. And that's how I will read it.
And do you say that to her when she's doing her podcast about fashion neurosis, called Fashion Neurosis? It's a podcast. Say what you want, Bella.
Absolutely, because she will, and she does. And she's also, no, of course, absolutely.
Well, Listen, it's been lovely to speak with you this evening. And now I have to go and read Bella's little story, the shorter stories that you mentioned, and see what the truth of what you're hiding in your fiction actually
Good
is.
Good luck with that.
I'd say
there is no truth.
What is the truth? We could be here for the rest of the evening trying to work that one out, Esther. Thanks for being with us this evening. Thanks for the conversation.
It's a pleasure. Goodbye.
That's Esther Freud, and Esther's new novel, let's be clear, is called My Sister and Other Lovers. It's published by Bloomsbury. This month, Galway's Nimmo's Pier is set to be transformed into a hub of controlled chaos as No Fit State Circus pitches its big top by the River Corrib for a run of Sabotage. Formed in the 1980s, No Fit State has turned into one of Europe's leading contemporary circus companies. Delighted to be joined this evening by Tom Rack, founder member of the group, and aerialist Gracie Marshall, the only Irish performer in this international ensemble, and whose picture I am looking at right now online, and I'll come to Gracie to ask her how she does this particular acrobatic feat in a few minutes' time. But Tom, let me start with you. Go back to the 1980s, and I think there was a group of you. Did you kind of bump into circus as much as anything else?
We started out as jugglers. That was our circus skill. But it was the 80s. It was kind of, you know, post-punk era, height of Thatcherism, convoy culture, that kind of rebellious streak of what was going on in the subculture at the time. And as friends who went to a juggling club, learnt to juggle, we started travelling around the festivals, street performing, having fun. You know, we were youngsters. We were living our best lives. We were going to the festivals, travelling around Europe, busking, just kind of enjoying ourselves. And then it kind of got out of hand, really. And here we are now.
Yeah, I wondered, had you any sense at that time of the 4 decades later, that 4 decades later you would be, you know, an international circus company on a massive scale, not just a couple of fellas going around doing a bit of juggling for as a street performers?
Not at all. I mean, it was as my friends were at university, we were all in Cardiff and some of them were at university and they finished. And it was like, well, do we all go our separate ways and go off and get jobs in the real world? Or shall we just take to the road and travel around in our big pink bus and entertain the people as we go? And that was kind of the start of it, really. Yeah. We didn't imagine it would stay that long. I'm the last remaining of the 5 who founded it. The others, you know, life happened to them. They all got jobs, girlfriends, and serious, whereas I'm the last man standing still here pushing the dinosaur up the hill.
I know, I think you're doing more than pushing the dinosaur up the hill, to be fair. Gracie, you're laughing there in the background. I can hear you. You are the only Irish performer in the troupe. Now, if Tom and his pals kind of stumbled into circus, as a circus rather, and he has stumbled through the intervening 4 decades to be where he is right now, your decision to go into the circus was full, whole, complete, and a very conscious decision. How did it happen?
Yeah, I jumped straight into it. Well, I was really into like dance a lot when I was younger, and I was taking a lot of dance classes. And then when I went to Electric Picnic one year and saw this amazing company called Lucent Dossier Experience, and then it was transition year and I had to find work experience. So I wrote to them and said, can I come and do 2 weeks of work experience with
you? Now, hold on. You wrote to them. This isn't a company that were from down the road a bit.
No, they're from LA. They're from the States. So I just sent them an email and was like, I'll chance it. And they responded being like, yeah, come. So I went and spent a month with them in LA when I was 16 and just did an internship with them. And then I came back home and was like, okay, I want to do this. I definitely want to go into circus. So from there, I went to London. I left school and I moved to London and did a diploma in circus in the National Centre of Circus Arts.
Even as you say that, I'm sure, you know, Tom must be sitting there saying, a diploma in circus, to imagine that that even exists now in whatever it would have been when you were doing it, Chris, I suppose, in the 20-teens at some point.
Yeah, 2012, I think, yeah.
Because, Tom, the attitude to circus, I think it is safe to say, has changed fundamentally in certainly the last 10 to 15 years.
Yeah, it has. And we were there at the beginning of that 40 years ago, and we've really seen that transition. People now get that circus is an art form. It's not, as was previously thought, popular entertainment and looked down on perhaps by the arts establishment. You know, people can actually now see that it's a legitimate art form in its own right. And what the contemporary circus movement, as it's now called, it was New Circus when we started, and then it was Circus Theatre, and now it's Contemporary Circus. But, you know, what we've done is taken the traditions of circus and reinvented them into a very different style of performance that is kind of just one coherent show. I mean, there's many traditional circuses out there who still do great work, but it's all of a traditional nature with the ringmaster, very episodic. But in our work, it's a coherent show. It just flows through. There's themes, there's dramaturgy, there's live music all the way through that keeps the action going, that drives it forwards. And we kind of tell a story, or we weave a multitude of stories. And it's just, it's so far removed from the kind of traditional idea of what circus is. And I'd say, you know, to people, if you think maybe circus is not for you, come along and see how it's moved on in the last 30 years, because really now it's something else. We've got exceptional artists from all over Europe putting together a great show.
And I'm looking, let me go to the picture. I mentioned Gracie Marshall, the Irish member of the No Fit State Circus Company. I don't even know how to describe this, but you mentioned the background in dance, Gracie, and I think that's vital to this picture. You are basically holding yourself up on one hand, low to the ground, so your arm is, one arm is holding you up in the on the ground, or kind of 6 feet, maybe 6 inches, a foot off the ground, and your legs holding, one of your legs holding a hoop, the other one stretched straight out behind you. I mean, the sheer physical strength and ability that's needed to hold that pose. I can only imagine it.
Years and years of training and practice every day.
Yeah, hours core strength. Core strength, I would guess, is a big part of what you do on a daily basis.
Yeah, for sure. Like, there's a certain amount of, like, I feel like I trained for 10 years quite a lot, and now there's just a certain level of maintaining that needs to be done. But I definitely before was like training like 8 hours a day when I was younger, and now it's like, okay, you need to do like 2 hours to kind of maintain everything. But we love it, and we love what we do. And like, for me, it's just, I love finding new tricks and new moves and like creative ways of doing circus.
Yeah, and I'm guessing, I mean, the picture I'm describing has you 1 foot off the ground. I'm guessing you spend a lot of the time in this show many feet up in the air, in fact.
Well, the show, what's great about this show is like, we're all kind of on stage all of the time, and we all do everything. So if we're not on stage, we're running up massive king poles and counterweighting other people, and like, it's such an ensemble show, and everyone's involved in making the machine work. So yeah, there's just so much of flying in the air.
Yeah, because I'm looking at another picture of one of the circus performers, and he is up on a very large metal contraption, which to me looks as if it's at least 20, if not 30 feet off the ground. But Tom, that title, Sabotage, that tells us, because if you're involved in sabotage, you're a saboteur, I'm guessing. What? Tell us the story that you're telling, because it is a story that you're telling across the evening's performance.
Well, I think you hit it there when you said, you know, you're a saboteur. And I'd say, you know, actually, what is sabotage? Sabotage is the collective of the saboteurs, of the individuals who make up the company and who bring their lived experience and their life stories to the performance. And to a degree, you know, by the nature of what we do, we're the outsiders, the misfits, the kind of dispossessed, the slightly weirdos and maybe not quite freaks, but well, maybe some of them. And we live kind of on the edges and on the margins of society. And we look at all the issues of gender and we've got an asylum seeker in the show. There's a disabled lad in the show. You know, everybody is very, very, you know, they bring their whole personality to the performance, and that's what makes it. And their stories are kind of woven through the work. And I say, you know, everybody's story is woven through, and you can kind of weave your own tapestry from what's on offer. You can sit back and see the bigger picture, or you can choose to follow a particular artist's journey through the show. There's a dramaturgy there. There's themes. We want people to see all of us for who we are. The saboteurs standing up for themselves, making a noise, being heard, expressing themselves in a different way, but being accepted. And it's just a different way of seeing it.
To what extent would you say, Gracie, that this is as much a being in the circus is a choice of career? It's actually a choice of a way of life.
Yeah, completely.
So what makes it different, do you think, in that respect? Different from, you know, the 9-to-5 job where you go in, you go wherever you go, you get the train home and you sit and you watch telly for the rest of the night. What makes your job and life different from that?
Well, so like with this company, we tour 6 months of the year and then have 6 months off. So we're on tour for that entire 6 months, and we like travel from place to place with like our home, with our caravans and our homes, and then we make our home in each space that we're at. And then like we build the tent together, we take down the tent together. We're very much like eating, living all the time together. And it's a tiny little community basically of like 30 of us that all live and work together. So you're basically in this community that's like moving, and you're doing shows every night and then like training every morning. And yeah, it's pretty, it's like 9 till 9.
Yeah. I think that comes across on stage, you know, the way that we all live together and travel together, and the fact that everybody puts literally their lives in each other's hands, you know, every day, 4 times a day.
Yeah. I was going to say on a nightly basis, but it is 4 times a day. You have several shows. Listen, thanks to both of you for speaking to us this evening. I'm hoping to be, well, I will be down in Galway next week, and I must check if I can make my way in to see the spectacles. I must say the pictures themselves would attract me into see what you're doing.
You have to come. You'll be blown away.
Thanks, Gracie. Thanks, Tom. That's Gracie Marshall and Tom Rack. Sabotage is the name of the show from the No Fit State, which will be at the Galway International Arts Festival, Nimmo's Pier, from July the 11th through until the 27th. And for that and everything at the festival, GIAF.ie. That's our lot for this Tuesday evening. Leah Murphy and Paula Shields researched. Dolly Hamilton was the broadcast coordinator. Tommy O'Sullivan was on sound. And tonight's programme was produced by Sinead Egan. Back with you tomorrow night, 7 o'clock, here on RTÉ Radio 1. John Creedon will be with you after the news.